Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and continued in his memory by a group of his colleagues. This is John Roberts. We received word this week that Dr. Iyad El-Sarraj, founder of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, died after a long struggle with cancer. He was 70 years old. This giant among humanitarians will be long remembered for the courageous work he did to try to heal the psychic wounds of entrapped Gazans who suffered from the devastating effects of prolonged occupation, particularly children and women. I first met Dr. El-Sarraj in 2001 when a delegation from Boston visited the Gaza Mental Health Program. He subsequently came to Boston on several occasions over the years, and those who were blessed to meet with him were always moved by the magnitude of the struggle in Gaza and the courage he displayed in carrying out his mission to treat a beleaguered and deeply stressed population under military occupation. This morning I will read a tribute to Dr. Iyad El-Sarraj, written by Nancy Murray, who was a dear friend and colleague of his for a quarter of a century. Nancy is co-founder of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation, which raised and continues to raise much-needed funds to support the work of Dr. El-Sarraj through the Gaza Community Health Program. Here is Nancy Murray's remembrance of Dr. Iyad El-Sarraj. Dr. Iyad El-Sarraj, who died on December 17th at the age of 70, was intimately acquainted with trauma and what cycles of violence do to the human psyche and society. The founder of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program in 1990, he made helping people move beyond their personal and collective trauma to recognize the basic humanity of all human beings his life's work. Human rights and mental health went hand in hand for a man who, as a four-year-old, was forced to flee with his family from Beer El Saba, now Beersheba, to Gaza when the State of Israel was established. After Gaza and the West Bank came under Israeli occupation in 1967, his father and brother were among the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were arrested and faced torture under interrogation. As he told the Boston Globe in April 1997 when he was in Boston to receive the first Human Rights Award given by the Physicians for Human Rights, "I started as a physician in Gaza and did not want to be involved in politics. But many of my patients were victims of torture, and I became drawn into advocacy. Defending human rights is my major obsession." Iyad El-Sarraj studied medicine in Alexandria, Egypt in 1971, and in 1973 went to London to study psychiatry. He became the Gaza Strip's first psychiatrist when he returned there in 1977. I first met Iyad when I went to Gaza in 1988 as part of a fact-finding delegation soon after the first Intifada began. I will never forget the shock of seeing hospitals full of young men and children who had endured the force, might, and beatings that then Israeli Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin had ordered to put down an unarmed uprising of the entire population, and of hearing the screams, gunshots, and the wailing of ambulances all night long. In 1988 and for the next 5 years, a 7 p.m. curfew was imposed on Palestinians. Sometimes they would endure house arrest for days and even weeks at a time, but every night they had to be off the streets by 7 p.m. The driver of one small white Renault was not about to abide by this military order. Instead, every evening, Iyad would go where he was needed, giving solace and medical attention. He made no attempt to avoid the IDF convoys, but instead would purposely go his way, sometimes with me in the passenger seat. So brazen was he in breaking the rules that the soldiers must have assumed he had a special permit, which he did not. What he did have was a determination to live in open, nonviolent defiance of occupation, both as an assertion of his own humanity and in recognition of the humanity of others, Israelis as well as Palestinians. There was a feature story about Iyad in the Canadian magazine Equinox, published in February 1995, which illustrates this quality. He was once stopped during the Intifada and ordered by an Israeli soldier to extinguish flames from a burning tire with his bare hands. He refused the order. When the soldier threatened to take his identification card, El-Serraj didn't protest. "Go ahead, take it. I don't care," he said. And when the soldier threatened to beat him, El-Serraj said, "Go ahead, but before you do, I know there's a real human being behind that uniform, and I would like you to show me that person." The soldier got tears in his eyes, and then he just walked away. How is it possible to maintain sanity under the dehumanizing conditions of occupation? While the first Intifada at its peak, Iyad set about creating a center that would work to overcome the stigma attached to mental illness and provide family and community-based treatment on a huge scale. I well remember a discussion we had in 1989 about his ideas for the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. It sounded to me like it would be a project of many years in the making. But the very next year, when I visited Gaza, the headquarters was already built and the staff was being trained. Soon the mental health program had clinics in the refugee camps and had established a range of training programs, crisis intervention programs, special projects that worked with children and empowered women, and a training and education department offering courses for teachers and nurses, as well as a postgraduate diploma in community mental health and human rights. By the mid-1990s, Dr. El-Serraj had become the Commissioner General of the Palestinian Independent Commission for Citizens' Rights. When, in 1995 and then again in 1996, he criticized the human rights practices not just of the Israeli occupiers, but of the Palestinian Authority, he was arrested on three occasions and severely beaten in prison. He later ended up giving counseling to the guards who had participated in his beating and who themselves had been tortured in Israeli prisons. As the situation in Gaza grew ever more desperate following the onset of the Second Intifada in 2000, Iyad attempted to awaken the conscience of the world with his writings, published research, media appearances, and in powerful speeches which he gave in Boston and countries across the globe. And as the bloodletting intensified, so did his appeals for urgent international intervention to bring an end to Israel's occupation and the endless cycle of violence. "The people who are committing the suicide bombings in this Intifada," he stated, "are the children of the first Intifada, people who witnessed so much trauma as children." His courage, decency, independence of mind, and vision of a better world made him a beacon of moral conscience and hope for those Israelis seeking peace with Palestinians and Palestinians struggling with both the occupation and their own ruinous political divisions. These qualities earned him respect across the political spectrum, as evidenced by the film The Gatekeepers, and considerable international recognition. In addition to the 1997 Physicians for Human Rights Award, he received the Martin Ennals Award for Human Rights Defenders in 1998. In 2010, when he was already ill with multiple myeloma, he was awarded the Olof Palme Prize for his self-sacrificing and indefatigable struggle for common sense, reconciliation, and peace between Palestine and Israel. And the Juan José López Ybor Prize in psychiatry. When hope was in short supply, an early morning walk on the beach, an afternoon playing with his young son Ali, or an evening spent with friends among the flowers of his garden in Gaza City would rejuvenate Iyad's spirits and faith in the basic goodness of human beings. He even found some positive things to say about the cancer which was finally to take his life. "It is just another form of life," he wrote me. "Different, but it can have good sides to it. You rest, you enjoy the things you always wanted to do, you enjoy life even more. I consider it a blessing because it made me appreciative of so many things I took for granted, like the color green of my plants, or enjoying the pleasure of helping Ali to wash his bottom." Dr. Iyad El Sarraj leaves behind a bereaved Palestine, a grieving family, and friends around the world who will miss him deeply. That was a remembrance of Dr. Iyad El Sarraj written by Nancy Murray, his friend and colleague and co-founder of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation. Nancy lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and will continue her work to support the Gaza Mental Health Foundation. And what follows now is an interview with Nancy Murray, which was conducted before the death of Dr. El Sarraj. Nancy led a delegation to Palestine for the Interfaith Peace Builders in late October, and I wanted to talk with her as one who has been traveling to Palestine for many years, particularly to get her take on the changes in the occupied territories over that period of time. Nancy has led many trips to Palestine, including the first one I took in 2001. She has written a book on Palestine and many articles and given countless speeches describing the conditions in the occupied territories. Here is my interview with Nancy Murray concerning her recent trip to Palestine and Israel. Okay, Nancy, you've been involved in the Israel-Palestine issue for years and years and years. More than a decade, you've been over at least 12 times. You've led many trips. You've written a book. You follow this day in and day out, and you've just returned from Palestine, having led a group there. And I would be interested in you're talking about what's happening there now and what kind of changes you see. What are the direction? What's happening there that we ought to be concerned about? Mm-hmm. And how different is it now than, you know, when you first went over? Mm-hmm. But just that perspective of a decade or so of trips to Israel.
Actually, now, you know, John, it's more than a decade. My first trip was back in 1988.
Oh, my, yeah.
So that's getting on for, what, 25 years?
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Yeah, so then when one went, and I went during the first Intifada, it was only a few months old. First of all, I mean, just imagine, that little territory seemed much larger because you could move through it freely. So you weren't constantly aware of walls and checkpoints and settlements. You could move from the West Bank to the Gaza Strip. The army was everywhere because at the time the Israeli army was, of course, putting down the Intifada, which had erupted in all cities and towns in the rural areas. And when I say erupted, I don't mean a violent eruption. I meant marches, demonstrations, showing the Palestinian flag, which was an offense for which you could get jailed. You know, all forms of expression of people rising up and saying, we won't take this anymore. We are basically protesting the occupation. We want to shake it off. That's what the word Intifada means. So although, you know, when you drive around, you run into the army, and you'd see the army breaking bones and basically, you know, arresting large numbers of people and that kind of thing. You don't see what you see now. What I saw this time, and I haven't been there in 3 years, what I saw this time was an expression on the ground of the West Bank of what is called Eretz Israel. Now, Eretz Israel is the religious settler concept of the West Bank as being the biblical blueprint which all Jews have as a birthright. Mm. And when I say I saw it imposed on the ground, it wasn't just through the settlements, which were everywhere. In the last couple of years, you know, they had gone completely in a feverish mode as far as building settlements. So you have them on practically every hilltop, and they're all fortress-like and glowering down at Palestinian pieces of land. But it wasn't just settlements. You also had now the wall, which is now 270 miles long, that giant 28-foot-high in some places wall, is, you know, now a real fixture, but also lesser walls and checkpoints everywhere. I mean, there are still hundreds of checkpoints. This now has an air of permanence because the checkpoints are in many cases now done in a way that they kind of, you still have the army there, but they're almost impersonal, the way, you know, the doors slide open and shut. I mean, they're like transit stations. They're there to stay, clearly. Mm-hmm. But you also have these road signs everywhere in the West Bank, which are now having indications of Jewish settlements and skipping out Palestinian towns. It's like, you know, as far as we're concerned, they don't exist.
This is on roads other than the bypass roads? You mean roads where...
We were on, because we had a bus, which had was a Jerusalem touring company bus. Mm. We were able to go on those bypass roads.
So you had the yellow plates.
So we went on, yeah, we had those. And so it's mainly on those roads where I saw the signage. But the signage was really striking, because you really got a sense of how it appeared to the mind of settlers. This is what they are going to claim as their own. They are not going to give it up. And, you know, as far as they're concerned, the Palestinians don't exist. And I say that in a way which is not just a figure of speech, but let me give you an example. We went to a place outside of Bethlehem called the Tent of Nations, which is a piece of land owned by Daoud and Amal, brother and sister Nasser is their last name. And for over 12 or 15 years, settlements have been growing around them, and the settlers have been wanting their land. Now they're surrounded by five different settlements. For 12 years, they have been fighting in court to keep their land. They have land deeds going way back to the Ottoman period. But at one stage, they'll be in court for 8 years, and then suddenly the judge will say, oh, these are not good enough, you have to go back to Istanbul and get the originals, you know, this kind of thing. Constant attacks by settlers, you know, their houses destroyed, their olive trees destroyed, and so on. But the striking thing is, and the reason I bring them up, because that's a pretty typical story now, but the reason I bring them up is that we were told a story by Amal, the sister, that she had been at a bus stop, and there was a settler woman at the same bus stop, and the settler woman said to her, who are you, in a kind of aggressive way, and she said her name, and she said, and I live here. And the settler woman, who I think might have been Russian, said, no, you don't, no one lives there. And she really had no idea that there was anyone else on the land, that her settlement was high up on a hill, and I guess she couldn't see, because they're now, by the way, living largely in caves, because their structures have been demolished. At any rate, Amal is a very, very accessible and persuasive person. And she said, you know, you should come and see. Come and see for yourself, and you'll see I live there. And the settler woman did go and see. And the next time she came, she brought her husband. And the next time they came to celebrate their anniversary with her. So these ties wow. have been formed. But, you know, the settler woman said, I had absolutely no idea. And so unless you have that kind of human contact, And, you know, Israel is certainly not encouraging it. In fact, now West Bank Jews are, Israeli Jews are barred from entering the West Bank. But unless you do have that kind of contact, as far as it appears to the mind of settlers, Palestinians do not exist, except as a nuisance, or in the mind, we were told by the head of the settlers at Beit Hadassah in the middle of Hebron, his name was David Wilder, we were told.
Oh, yes.
Did you meet him?
Yes, and I've heard him speak, and he's been here, yeah.
Yes, we were told, all Palestinian towns are nests of terrorism. And he said, there will never be a Palestinian state. And I must say, having seen what I saw on the ground, it is now impossible to imagine a Palestinian state. Because, you know, it's not just the one wall and the settlements here and there, but now it is clear that, you know, all of the vital points, aquifers, the valuable pieces of land in terms of agriculture, olive trees, I mean, the gates in the big settlement, the big separation wall, the so-called apartheid wall, you know, they're supposed to be gates to allow farmers to get to their land. Those gates are, in many cases, never open. In some cases, the farmers are issued a visitor's permit to go through a gate, but the person who is supposed to take the permit is never there, et cetera, et cetera. So what's happening in large part of the rural areas is that what is Palestinian land, they're not getting access to do anything with their olive trees. So after 3 years, you know, it's called abandoned land and can be taken as state land. So what I saw was a frightening level of dispossession and forced displacement of Palestinians from their land, both in the rural areas and in the towns, and not in the towns in Area A, but certainly in East Jerusalem. The towns in Area A have their own problems. That's where the Palestinian Authority is supposedly in control, and that's a whole other story to talk about them. But let's just leave that aside for 1 second. East Jerusalem, the demolition orders are just being multiplied. When we were there, demolition orders were placed on apartment buildings in one East Jerusalem neighborhood that will that are lived in by 15,000 Palestinians. These 70 apartment buildings, each with 40 or 50 apartments in them, are all now slated to be demolished. I mean, they're trying to get rid of Palestinians from East Jerusalem. We see it in Silwan, where we went around and saw all the houses with demolition orders on them and heard, again, terrible stories because they want to turn Silwan into a City of David theme park. So it's all around East Jerusalem. It's certainly in the rural areas, and it is inside Israel itself. I mean, the Palestinian Israelis who have citizenship are also suffering from the threat of forced displacement, as we saw when we visited in the Negev, where he visited the Bedouin, who are now trying to resist what's called the Prower Plan, which is to move them off their land into these miserable little townships. And we sat with them in the desert. We sat in El Arakib, in this place where, since July 2010, there had been over 60 attacks on this one town of Arakib. And people are now, the reason they're still there is because they're living in the cemetery. I mean, they've destroyed all of their buildings, but they're now in the cemetery. And they appeal to us, please, please, urge the U.S. government to do something about the Prower Plan. Do not, you know, tell Israel, you can't do this to people. Everywhere we looked, when we visited them, there are now eucalyptus trees being planted on what was their grazing land. Eucalyptus trees are the most water-greedy trees of all, but they grow fast. So the sheikh of the town told us each of those trees is like a soldier with his gun pointed at us. And that's, you know, the Jewish National Fund's contribution to getting rid of Palestinians. So it was a, you know, you could say it's almost as if under the Netanyahu government, which is a of course, not only a settler government, but a religious settlers have a high degree of power there. They're going for broke, and the world is letting them do it, which I find just, you know, very, very heartbreaking. The other thing I found, if you compare it to when I was first there, and the spirit of the Palestinian people was so high, even as they were being repressed in such awful ways. I mean, after 25 years in the West Bank of this ongoing repression, people are really tired. Now, I won't say that about all people. We met with the Popular National Committees who are organizing in the villages these amazing nonviolent resistance demonstrations every week to save land that's being threatened by the wall or by settlements. And, you know, they were incredibly stalwart. It's really hard to imagine what they have gone through. In the case of Berlin, we stayed with the family who produced the film Five Broken Cameras, the Barnat family, and there, 9 years, once a week, they would go out and demonstrate and have tear gas and rubber bullets and live ammunition fired at them. Can you imagine? Nine years.
Yeah, the irony is that the Palestinians have this terrorist image put on them, and yet there's just a long history of passive, of nonviolent resistance that Mazen Qumsi has written about. But it is amazing because they have that other image that's put upon them, and it's when you go there, it's quite the opposite. There's this incredible nonviolent resistance going on.
And not only that, you have this amazing gentleness, humanity, and hospitality. We stayed with families, and you know, families whose olive trees are threatened by settlers. We were there as part of an olive harvest delegation, so we really got to see what they were experiencing when they tried to harvest their olives. And you know, in spite of this constant harassment and constant threat to their very being, and certainly to their livelihood, they managed just to show us the most extraordinary level of hospitality. I mean, it really does make you you rethink what it means to be a human being. And they certainly have developed that capacity to the fullest. So the humanity of the Palestinians is strikingly still there, despite what is clearly exhaustion in many places, clearly this sense of despair about the leadership, because, as we were told by several people, you know, the PA is now, it has its own security forces, which repress Palestinian Democrats.
It's just seen as collaborators, basically.
I wouldn't say just seen as collaborators by many people, because many people, I think, certainly as partners in repressing demonstrations, I don't think they're seen as collaborators in the sense that they are embracing the Israeli agenda. Mm-hmm. But it's like they've, you know, they're now in comfortable positions, many of them. The PA controls the budgets of, say, the teachers and so on and so forth. And so many people have a stake in getting a salary because the economy is so wretched that a lot of people don't want the PA to disappear because this is how their livelihood
is. Oh, yes.
Yeah, so in that sense, you know, it's more complicated than just collaborators. But when it comes to policing demonstrations, yes, then they are doing Israel's job. I mean, probably not happily, but that's what they've been trained to do. Right. And they will only get the money if they continue to do it. And that was pretty depressing. So I think one of the very alarming things is that this incredible village resistance, the Popular Resistance Committees, has not spread to the towns. The towns, and part of that is because of the fragmentation. So when I was first there, you know, people from one town could go meet with people of another town. East Jerusalem could come down to Gaza City. You know, Nablus, they could meet with people from Hebron. You could plan things. Yeah. You could have a sort of understanding of what the resistance was all about. And it was, territory-wide. And then, of course, we're not just talking the West Bank. We were talking the West Bank and Gaza. Mm-hmm. So now, you know, how do you organize when you can't even travel a couple hundred yards from one town without meeting a checkpoint? How do you organize? How do you get together? People can't go into Jerusalem.
No.
You know, how do you do it? And I think that's what they're really grappling with. It's just immeasurably harder to have any kind of, you know, when people talk about a third intifada, it's hard to imagine how it would look given the level of fragmentation. You know, when I say fragmentation, what I'm talking about is people being separated by all these barriers, you know, military checkpoints, military guard towers, you know, permits needed, all of that. You know, so it makes it really tough to imagine how these village resistance movements could really be taken up sort of in a way which was coordinated and which could really, you know, be effective. Because now, you know, I was thinking of, in our own civil rights movement, you know, you had the walk across the Edmund Pettus Bridge for voting rights, and the Alabama state troopers come in and they beat everybody, and that's televised. It's known as Bloody Sunday, and people see it, and they go down to join the next march.
Right.
And it causes this momentum. So the third time they march, they actually get across the bridge and succeed in marching to Montgomery. Here, imagine that you've been doing this every Friday for 9 years, and you get your heads beaten in. Get your heads beaten in. There have been deaths, and people just aren't paying attention. You know, that's when you begin to say, does nonviolent resistance work if no one pays attention? And it's a real horrifying dilemma because they're determined to keep doing it. But just 2 days before we met with Ayad Bernat at Belin, he had been in the hospital, shot at the latest demonstration with steel bullets covered with rubber. Ended up in the hospital. They fired tear gas right into his house. You know, this is just another Friday. And you know, you go to these villages, and there were like mountains of tear gas canisters, all made in Pennsylvania. Mountains of them that had just been collected after, you know, these attempts to march and demonstrate. So people are resisting, and they're getting clobbered, and the Israelis, it's one big shrug, except for the ones who are there on the front lines with them. But we traveled a lot in Israel, and what we discovered was, as we were told by Dorothy Naor, who's an 82-year-old activist with a group called New Profile, which is trying to lessen militarism inside Israel. She said, basically, Israelis don't know about the occupation and don't care. And that is the sense you get. They're in a comfortable place now. They could just ignore what's going on. Their economy is roaring along thanks to national security industry. And, you know, they basically, you know, don't want to make peace because you can't make peace with terrorists. They've been so indoctrinated. And I must say, Dorothy told us one thing which would be pretty frightening if it happens, which is that there's a proposal to teach the Holocaust every year from kindergarten to 12th grade. The idea being to teach those kids that you only have yourself to rely on, the world is against you.
And you're a victim.
And you're a victim, and those Arabs next door, you can't trust them. And so, you know, I was hoping that, you know, as the generations, you know, a future generation perhaps could start to see the humanity of their neighbors, but if this happens,
and there are a lot of the secular, more liberal element, Israel are leaving in droves, just leaving, and sort of leaving it more to the ideologues and the religious right, and
I'm afraid that's true.
Yeah,
no, our trip around Israel was not encouraging. We did go to Sderot, and we heard about, you know, from this amazing woman who has been trying to get her neighbors to recognize that you can't just hate the people across a few yards away in the Gaza Strip. Her name was Noga Kadman, And then we went and saw in Sderot itself Nomika Zion, who is someone, she started something called Other Voice to try to raise consciousness within Sderot that the Gazans are people too, and then to try to get a bigger collection of Israelis to recognize that, you know, just bombing people and, you know, sending your F-16s and, you know, like they did in Castlet, is just not going to lead to any kind of peaceful solution. Now, Sderot now has, of course, the Iron Dome, so they no longer worry so much about incoming rockets from the Gaza Strip. But she, you know, she told us how her whole trajectory to get to during Castlet, to realize that, you know, this was not the way to go. And it's good to know there are still Israelis of conscience like her who think deeply about this stuff. But most of the ones we met, including like students and young professionals, and, you know, people who are just, you know, not perhaps, maybe because now the contact between Palestinians and Israelis is so much less. In her case, she's of an age where she knew Palestinians. Now, if you're young and you've never met a Palestinian practically, you know, you could believe anything about them.
Yeah.
And that seems to be what is happening. So that was really very depressing. What's happened to Hebron was unspeakable. I could not believe my eyes. Since how it is emptied out in the downtown part, just since I was there 3 years ago, it's now a complete ghost town. Mm-hmm. And the settler impunity is just astonishing there. So that's really the story that I bring back, which is that, it's hard to see how there can possibly be a state when the whole, it's not just settlements, it's this whole apparatus of repression, division, and appropriation of land, which is there to stay. So that's one. And number two, how little willingness there seems on the Israeli side to engage with Palestinians as human beings. Palestinians, I think, showed much more openness. Not only, I gave you the story of the Tent of Nations woman who reached out to settlers inside these popular resistance committees. We talked to some of the, Bassam Tamimi is his name, and Nadi Saleh, and he said, and he was a veteran of the First Intifada who spent a lot of time in jail, and he basically has said to us, you know, they've been having these weekly demonstrations too, and he said, well, some of the settlers are beginning to see things a little differently. So, you know, you could see the Palestinians really trying to reach out, but I don't think it's...
Yeah, I mean, I think, for the most part, the settlers are the real ideologues, you know, much more than you might find in Israel proper, but... So if you can begin to change settlers, you really...
Now, I think the other thing, though, that in terms of where to go from here, I mean, everybody. Within Israel, we talked to a group called Boycott From Within, and within the West Bank, everybody pretty much across the board said it has to be boycott, divestment, and sanctions. That's the only thing that will impact Israel. Even if it doesn't impact them economically, just for them to be forced to know the world does care about what they're doing, and they can't just get away with it and do it with total impunity, that is the only thing that will really get through to them. So I thought that was interesting that was a uniform message now. So I guess that's what I would bring back here and say, we really have to ratchet up what we're doing in terms of BDS.
Well, that's right, and people have to know what's going on there, because it's, you know, people do not realize this is one of the real human rights crises in the world today, and we're so involved in it.
Yeah, we are.
And we're for the most part the it's not only the Israeli society that's protected from it; it's the American also,
and we're
protected from it. We're so much a part of it.
Yeah.
And that this whole idea of a peace process is nothing but buying time to allow mm-hmm. them to continue to take the land, which has always been the Zionist vision, was take the land. And so the longer we can string out this so-called peace process, the more land that's taken, the more difficult it is to create a state, and they're accomplishing their goal.
Right.
And
no, that is all very true. I guess, you know, when I think about where things have moved, I a great sadness to me, because I've spent a lot of time in the Gaza Strip, is the fact that the other thing that's changed so much is that West Bankers didn't even refer to Gaza. It's like they've really succeeded in separating the two.
Right.
And that is terrible. When you think of what's going on in Gaza now, which is completely horrific. You know, it's been horrific since 2007, but now with sewage, people wading through sewage in the streets of Gaza City because everything is broken down. There's no electricity to run the pumps. Everything is broken down ever since the Egyptian military takeover, and the gates were again slammed on Gaza, and they used to be able to get gasoline through tunnels, but now the tunnels are all closed. And, you know, I find we're sitting here, you know, more or less shrugging or not even paying attention while people there. It really is there, a slow genocide.
It's treated the way prisons are treated here. We take people, we put them in prisons, we forget about them.
Exactly.
Now Gaza is a prison, and, you know, and we forget about it. We lock them up.
But even in the West Bank, it's now like, I won't say that people have accepted that now there's the separation, but, you know, it's like that's what they're forced to have to accept because there's so little likelihood of it not being that way in the near future. So that really was a development which hurt very much. One thing I was worried about going, I've taken delegations there during the First Intifada and the Second Intifada, and I wondered, what is it going to be like going when presumably there is no Intifada, instead of there's a peace process? And I thought, you know, okay, I took 23 people from around the country. Some had been there before, but many hadn't. And, you know, how would they see it? Because it won't be as dramatic as, you know, Israeli soldiers everywhere. I needn't have worried. Day one, we were in Ida camp and we got tear gassed because there were Israeli soldiers. I mean, people think now that Israel has, you know, withdrawn from these areas. But they were there. And the reason they were there at Ida camp was because the night before, the prisoners, 26 prisoners, were released, and three of them were from Ida. So they had returned to Ida, and they were expecting, I don't know, jubilation, celebration, which they had to be there to control, I don't know why.
Yeah, right.
But in fact, what happened was some little kids, when our bus drove up, some little kids, and I mean little, they were like 7 years old, were throwing stones in the direction of the soldiers who were like 50
when you're seven, away. You can't throw very far.
And so they come galloping up with their tear gas, and our group got in the middle of it. And, you know, that was like a beginning, an eye-opening.
There's an orientation for you.
Yes. You know, so, and then they heard such astonishing things in that very first day that from then on they just, you know, were prepared to, their eyes were fully opened, and it didn't take another intifada to do it.
Right.
So, I mean, I would hope that as many Americans as possible go there. I was not certain that would be my reaction, because I also think, gosh, people have been going back and forth for decades, and Palestinians see them, and they must be sick of it. You know, here's another delegation. Well, it's not going to bring any change. I mean, that's what I thought people would, how people would react. But in fact, people were very happy to have us there. They really are afraid they're going to be forgotten. And with, you know, Syria and the whole, you know, world, that
right.
whole region in complete turmoil, you could see why they thought that. So I would really encourage people to go see for yourself. This delegation was one that was organized by Interfaith Peace Builders in Washington, D.C. They did a brilliant job. It's the only delegations that get a training before they go. So there was a 2-day training first everyone met each other ahead of time, which was really good. So when we got tear gassed, we already had, you know, we knew who each other were.
Right.
And we, you know, the training included a lot of background information. And then afterwards, they really help you write op-eds, write, you know, contact the media, get interviewed. They help you set up ways to have forums, go see your congressman and so on. That is really what they're interested in doing. So they're a very good group, and they have at least two, sometimes three delegations a year. And they always have an olive harvest one if people are interested in that.
Oh, that's good. People need to go. People need to go. Yeah. Well, Nancy, thank you, I think. Really, the word has to go out, I hope, in some way that this story does get out and that this delegation is successful in reaching the media and the Congress and whatever that we need to do. And building BDS, that's crucial.
Right, and if I could just say one final thing, you know, when you think about it, you think, well, what would it take to change this? And we did have a little glimmer of what it would take when, back in 1991, George Bush Sr. linked $10 billion in loan guarantees to a settlement freeze. Now, he managed to shut Congress up by basically presenting this as a matter of American foreign policy. This is our interest, you know, and the implication being, who are you, whose side are you really on? Are you, you know, where's your loyalty? And Congress pretty much fell into line. Now, what happened then was after they managed to get rid of the Shamir government. It was Itzhak Shamir's government was the one that, you know, was going full broke for settlement expansion, very much the way Netanyahu's government is going now. As soon as they got rid of that government and there was a Labor government, then they relented and, you know, it was business as usual. But this time, there has to be use of U.S. leverage. I mean, we have so much leverage through our military aid, for a start. Use of U.S. leverage to not just say stop the settlement expansion, but to say let us conduct U.S. foreign policy in terms of international law. So let us really go back and see what international law says and base a settlement on international law. And that would mean a real evacuation, not just of the settlements, but you'd have to knock down the apartheid wall, which is what the International Court of Justice said should be done anyway back in 2005. You have to get rid of the wall where it goes into, or 2004, I think it was, into the West Bank. So, you know, if we could only combine the leverage that we have with principles of international law, we could come to some kind of solution, which might not be the solution for all time, but it would certainly be a way to go forward now.
Right. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
That was an interview with Nancy Murray, who led a delegation to Palestine and Israel last October for the Interfaith Peace Builders. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a segment of Truth and Justice Radio. We're here every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. To stream the program live or access the archive of past broadcasts, go to www.wzbc.org. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.